Hello, and thanks for joining us on The Week in Review. I'm Brandis Friedman. No need to adjust your screen because Amanda Vinicky has the evening off. A fiery clash in Philadelphia as Kamala Harris and Donald Trump face off in their first and now perhaps only presidential debate.
Kamala Harris.
Let's have a good debate.
Thank you.
Harris showing from the jump she's not going to be intimidated, hitting Trump where it hurts, on crowd sizes and what she said was the fading appeal of his rallies.
You will see during the course of his rallies, he talks about fictional characters like Hannibal Lecter. He will talk about windmills cause cancer. And what you will also notice is that people start leaving his rallies early out of exhaustion and boredom.
People don't leave my rallies. We have the biggest rallies, the most incredible rallies in the history of politics. That's because people want to take their country back.
Donald Trump also doubling down on a false claim promoted by right-wing media.
In Springfield, they're eating the dogs, the people that came in. They're eating the cats. They're eating the pets of the people that live there.
And after watching the debate, one high-profile childless cat lady says she's voting for Harris. Meanwhile, in Chicago, Mayor Brandon Johnson's administration enacts a hiring freeze and limits overtime as the city faces a looming budget deficit.
We don't want to have to cut any services. I made that very clear. You know, I've been an organizer, I've been an elected official, and I know the damage that has been done over the course of bad decisions. But as a city, we have to be prudent and fiscally responsible in this moment.
The city also announcing plans to close 3 migrant shelters as fears of a fresh influx of migrants from the southern border fade. And black firefighters from New York join colleagues in Chicago to honor first responders killed on 9/11. And our Week in Review panel joining us now are Michael Liptrot from Southside Weekly, our own Heather Sharone of WTTW News, Laura Rodriguez-Presa from the Chicago Tribune, and Rob Hart of WBBM News Radio. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. So getting into it, 67 million viewers watched the presidential debate. What were all of your takeaways? What were your impressions? Michael Liptrot, let's start with you.
Someone definitely did their homework coming into the debate. And from the opening moment, walking to Donald Trump's podium to make sure that she got a handshake, it was clear Kamala Harris came with a mission to prove to America that though she was not elected in the primary, that she is the right pick. And Trump, his rhetoric wasn't too different from what we've seen in the past. A lot of conspiracy theories, a lot of just jabs to try to chink Kamala's armor, and asserting his own thoughts on what he did best during presidency. But ultimately, I think it proved a lot. And I heard a quote from an expert that debates don't win elections, governing does. And with both of them having White House experience, though for Kamala Harris, not the presidency, it showed a lot. But at this debate, it really conveyed the temperaments and what you could expect with either choice becoming president.
Heather Sharone?
So I think that you can't talk about this debate without talking about former President Donald Trump's false claims about immigrants eating dogs in Ohio. And I think we saw after the debate numerous bomb threats called into schools in Springfield, Ohio. The DMV had to be closed. City Hall had to be closed. And I think, you know, we all chuckled as we were sort of, you know, watching those remarks. But those remarks have had severe and profound consequences for the Haitian community in Springfield and elsewhere in America. And I think that we have a tendency, just as humans, to sort of laugh when somebody says something like that because it is farcical on its face, right? These are human beings. But I think it's important to remember that he has put a target on the back of a marginalized community, and we know they are suffering. And that, I think, is the state of politics in America today.
And just because it's false doesn't mean that it does not have impact on people.
Well, I mean, he's going back to the essence of Trump, right? That's the basis of why or how he ran and how he won in the first place. So he's doing what he's always done, which is have this, you know, anti-immigrant rhetoric, talking about immigrants and the things that creating this false narratives about them. And so then people follow through because that's what they like to hear from him. And he's appealing to the Trump supporters that we've known that he's created over the last few years.
And I watched the Springfield, Ohio saga just develop online and metastasize on September 9th. And it was very clear from the word go, this was incorrect. This was a flat-out lie. Public officials said this was not true. There were journalists who discovered the Facebook group in which this rumor originated. And basically, it was a person saying, well, I heard it from a friend who heard it from a friend, and so on and so forth. And even though everybody up and down the line said either this was a rumor or it couldn't be confirmed or it didn't happen, and you had online sleuths who had discovered, you know, the real source of some of these pictures that were being cited as proof, the people who were sharing it were gleefully sharing it, knowing it was wrong, knowing it was incorrect. The fact that it was a flat-out lie didn't bother them. And the question that a lot of people had leading up to the debate was, will this be mentioned in the debate? And sure enough, it was. And yes, it was the source of a lot of very funny Simpsons memes that people were sharing. But as Heather pointed out correctly, this has had a profound impact. Bomb threats have been phoned in. And in fact, our radio station, we talked to the Haitian community in Chicago, representatives, and they're keeping an eye on things because they want to see how it develops here in the Chicago area where we have a large Haitian community.
Michael, there are a lot of pundits on the left and the right saying that, you know, Kamala Harris got the best of Donald Trump. He says he won, and that as a result, he's on top of all of the, that, what was it, 90-something percent that he said, a pollster, of people who were polled said that he won it. What impact, and you mentioned this earlier, you know, like, debates don't win elections. It is governing that does, but what impact do you think the debate will have on voters?
I think it is the first time for a lot of people who are on the fence seeing what the realities of a Trump versus Harris election will look like. And when thinking about Trump's stance he took after the election, that he won, that Kamala needs him to do a third debate immediately after the debate. And then later on, you see on True Social, he says there will be no third debate. And throughout the debate, throughout Trump's presence in politics, the back and forth on his stance, and it really doesn't show someone who is secure in their judgment, and that it doesn't bode well. And when thinking about that in comparison to Harris, you do have someone who is very much in the legacy of Joe Biden and working to set herself apart from that legacy. And I appreciate the fact that at ABC, they pushed her on that. They pushed her on her stance when it comes to fracking, when it comes to other policies.
Some of her position changes.
Right, that she's changed on, and having a chance for people who have never viewed her as a presidential candidate to hear her speak candidly on that. So at this point, it's not even clear if there will be a third debate, just given Trump's track record when it comes to these type of statements. But at this point, if there was not a third debate, I think most Americans have seen what they need to see when it comes to this election.
Well, I was going to say, so one of the sharpest exchanges of the evening, it was over the issue of women's reproductive rights and access to abortion after the Supreme Court, of course, overturned the protections of Roe versus Wade. Here's what some or both candidates had to say on that subject.
Her vice presidential pick says abortion in the ninth month is absolutely fine. He also says execution after birth, it's execution, no longer abortion, because the baby is born, is okay. And that's not okay with me. It's the vote of the people now. It's not tied up in the federal government. I did a great service in doing it. It took courage to do it. And the Supreme Court had great courage in doing it. And I give tremendous credit to those six justices.
There is no state in this country where it is legal to kill a baby after it's born.
One does not have to abandon their faith or deeply held beliefs to agree. The government, and Donald Trump certainly, should not be telling a woman what to do with her body. You want to talk about this is what people wanted? Pregnant women who want to carry a pregnancy to term, suffering from a miscarriage, being denied care in an emergency room because the healthcare providers are afraid they might go to jail, and she's bleeding out in a car in the parking lot? She didn't want that. Her husband didn't want that. A 12 or 13-year-old survivor of incest being forced to carry a pregnancy to term? They don't want that.
Heather, that seemed to be one of Harris's strongest and most impassioned moments of the evening. How do you think it played?
Well, it was the clearest contrast between her and President Joe Biden. So if you remember all the way back 75 days ago in another era of America political history, he had a hard time sort of prosecuting the case against Donald Trump for overturning Roe versus Wade. And you heard the vice president clearly make that case in a way that the president just did not or could not. And I think that you heard a lot of relief and excitement from abortion rights advocates. You heard Governor J.B. Pritzker, who's been out there saying, this is what we need to talk about when we talk about abortion, the impact on women, on the impact on families. And I think that that is really the one of the clearest contrasts between the two candidates. And I think it's one where it could potentially be, you know, determinative in November, because we believe this election is going to be very close. So it will come down, I think, in large part as to the number of women who go out and vote, because we know that women overwhelmingly support abortion rights. I think whether Kamala Harris was able to make the case to those who are perhaps a little bit more on the fence that this is, you know, sort of not some extreme sort of, you know, fantasy, as we heard from the former president, but a question about women's health, I think that is one of the major issues this election will decide.
So also in that exchange that we just saw co-moderator Lindsay Davis. She's also fact-checking Trump. We know that David Muir did a little bit of that during the debate as well. Rob, what do you make of how the moderators were fact-checking Trump? Because Trump, the campaign, they've complained about that. They've said that the moderators were unfair and that it was three against one instead of just Trump against Kamala Harris.
But that has been his method of operation ever since he went down the escalator at Trump Tower 9 years ago. That has defined our discourse, that has defined our rhetoric, that has defined the way people talk to each other and how they sort themselves now ideologically, is that, you know, Donald Trump has like a fire hose of things to say. And you have a hard time keeping up with what's true and what's false and what's bravado and what's the old razzle dazzle, because he is, after all, a salesman. And for the first time in the history of Donald Trump debates, going all the way back to the Republican primaries in 2015, there was somebody there, a moderator, to say, hey, wait a minute, you're arguing from a false premise.
So an NPR PBS News Marist poll released hours before the candidates faced off showed that Trump was ahead of Harris among Latino voters, 51% to 47%. Now, this marks a 19-point shift from August when Harris led the former president by 15 points in the same voting group. Laura, what about Trump might appeal to Latino voters?
Well, I think there's a big misconception about the Latino vote, right? There's this idea that everything is based on immigration policies and how things are shaping up with that, and that is definitely not true, right? A lot of people are very much in different economic spaces. There's people that come from very small towns where people are very conservative. So they do believe, right, abortion is a big topic for a lot of older Latinos who may believe that he has, you know, the right policy in place, and definitely not Kamala Harris. So there's that idea of almost the machismo as well, right? And so it's a lot of issues that we don't really talk about, but they are inherently rooted. But we do see a lot of the most Latinos that support Trump are men, which then again shows, right, where that's coming from. With now a woman running against him, and Mexico has its first woman president as well. So I think that there is now that a little bit more of an open mind in seeing how things shape up. Yeah. Now that you know, we have Kamala and Trump.
Yeah, a bit of a shift. Yeah, we discussed this on Black Voices as well, about Black men in particular being attracted to Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And there being a little bit of discourse over supporting a Black woman, Black and South Asian woman in the race.
And let me just really add quickly, too. I think that, you know, the largest immigrant community in the States is Mexican, been here for a very long time. All of them are now educated business professionals. So they are making more money, so they are more, they want to fall under that idea that if they do pick him, the economy is going to be better, right? And obviously now with the migrant crisis, ironically, a lot of immigrants want a stronger security at the border, where I think is where, again, Harris has that stance of having a little bit more security at the border. So maybe that's where kind of things are shaping up and not, there's now harder to tell, you know, where they go.
So it can be kind of tough to tell whether or not endorsements are very useful. And within a half hour of the end of the debate, Kamala Harris got an endorsement from, let me see if I can get this name right, Taylor Swift. how much, you know, might that endorsement be worth given Swift's more than 280 million followers on social media? Dropping that out there. Go.
So you're not going to have a lot of people who are like, well, I was going to vote for Donald Trump, but Taylor Swift sells me now.
Now I'm switching.
But what it does potentially is expands the universe of potential voters. And we saw just literally hundreds of thousands of people use the link in that Instagram post that you're seeing right now to go to vote.gov to either register to vote or to check their voter registration. And when you have an election that we all expect to be sort of very tight in these sort of swing states, expanding the number of people who are registered to vote, who are considering voting, could make the difference. And that's who we're talking about here. And if you are a fan of Taylor Swift, I am hard-pressed to see how you would have watched Donald Trump at that debate and said, oh, he's talking about the issues that I care about. And when you have somebody like Taylor Swift saying, hey, I'm going to vote for the vice president, it sets up a permission structure so that you feel like you're maybe part of something. And that can be very powerful for people who, unlike me, don't live and breathe this sort of thing. I know, it's shocking to think there are people like that.
Yeah, I was going to mention that, right? I think that for most people, they only understand the very surface of it. They don't really understand everything else behind it. And so when you have someone like Taylor Swift say, hey, this is the best candidate, and they're already a fan, then they might just believe that, right? And I think that's kind of the power of celebrities.
Especially when thinking about young people. And among Gen Z and younger people who are just getting of age to vote, mm-hmm. that at the current state of politics are already at a level of cynicism and thinking that their vote doesn't matter and that the politics itself is going to play out how it plays out. Seeing someone like Taylor Swift can definitely be momentous in getting young people out to vote. Mm-hmm. And we've seen it in Chicago with how many young people can make an impact to an economy. Right. And so if half of those people that may not have been registered to vote get out, register to vote, and actually go out to vote inspired by someone they feel a connection with, someone that they've been listening to since they were 10 years old, that may be a difference.
The most famous Trump cat lady. Right.
And then we have to move on for Taylor Swift. Go on, Rob.
There have been celebrity endorsements since there's been politics. And I think a lot of people have been grumbling. Maybe you're grumbling right now. Watch, like, oh, Taylor Swift. I'm going to do what a celebrity tells me. Well, but this has been like Sammy Davis Jr. put Richard Nixon in a bear hug 52 years ago. I mean, this has been going on for a very long time. And as Heather points out, it's not, am I going to make a difference? Is this going to pull me away from Donald Trump? Am I going to vote for Harris or just stay home? And maybe on the margins that will make a difference.
Okay, so let's talk about the city budget because, Heather, there's been briefly, if you would, a little bit of mayoral staff drama.
Yes.
At City Hall this week.
So Kennedy Bartley is the Director of External Affairs in the mayor's office, and our former colleague, Perry Schutz, over at Fox 32.
Never heard of him.
Yeah. He found a podcast back in 2021 where she used a slur against police and called for police abolition. A number of older people had called for her to resign. She apologized for those remarks in an interview with me today. Go to our website. You can read the whole thing. But she denied heckling Alderman Deborah Silverstein during a debate about a resolution condemning the Hamas-Israel war back in October. The alder person said that she had been told by other alder people that Kennedy Bartley had done that. Kennedy said she did not do that and that she would not have done that. However, she said that she knew what she was doing when she tweeted, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, in the days after the October 7th attack. She said that that was meant to express solidarity with the pro-Palestinian people and to sort of urge a creation of a Palestinian state. She said, however, now she's more mindful that that phrase has been weaponized by Hamas to call for the eradication of Israel.
Of course. Okay, now we got to talk about the budget. City announcing that it's enacting a hiring freeze and limiting overtime to help address this $223 million budget shortfall for this year and projected shortfall of nearly $1 billion, billion with a B, next year. Of course, the city has also added on to that, saying that police and fire will be exempt from that hiring freeze. Heather, how much of a difference will these measures make? Because they're not going to find it in the couch cushions.
They are not. So maybe about $100 million by the end of the year, based on some projections that have been shared by the budget office. But there are big structural problems that the city has to face. Its pension debt is enormous. The city is going to spend $2.8 billion in 2025 to sort of make up for the years that they did not contribute to employees' pensions. So there are big questions facing Mayor Johnson, and there are no easy answers.
Laura, you've written a couple of stories this week about Little Village. One is about the restoration of the Little Village Arch. Another about fears of the new Starbucks heralding displacement potentially. What do those two stories say about where the Little Village community is right now, and how great are those gentrification fears?
Well, I don't know if it's because it's September and Hispanic Heritage Month and also Mexican Independence Day coming up, but there's certainly a focus in the Mexican community right now. We started with the Starbucks story. That's something that has been actually on the works for about 2 years. So it's nothing new, but it just so happened that the community finally realized when they put the Starbucks name on top, and it actually was a part of the Novak construction plan back when they bought the plaza in 2020, when community really, really tried to fight to stay in the neighborhood, to keep local businesses in the neighborhood. So what they're really worried about now, it's the potential gentrification. And obviously with that, higher property taxes, higher property values in the area, and then therefore displacing some of the people there. So it's kind of an interesting fight there, because there are some people that are completely against it, but there are many more people that believe that this is actually good for the neighborhood. It's an economic opportunity. It shows that they're growing, they're expanding, that there is a lot more economic power happening. Just a few months ago, I wrote a story about Pilsen and the gentrification there, and it showed that the neighborhood is still predominantly Latino, but the income is higher. So then that changes the conversation. So is gentrification just about displacing immigrants and bringing in, white folks, or is it because of an economic displacement? And then the Little Village Arch, that goes, again, right next to Starbucks. So was it a plan that was in the place already or not? But it's right next to each other, right next to it, and it's a $1.25 million renovation that happened to the arch, and people celebrated that. It's just ahead of the Mexican Independence Day.
Okay. Also, the anniversary of 9/11 this week, of course, 23 years. One thing I saw on social media is that some people, to mark the day, might read the same article that they have read every year, just to sort of like commemorate the day for themselves. I know someone who reads the story of the Falling Man, which I think is in Esquire, just every year on the same day on 9/11 to honor those who died. Do any of you do anything to sort of mark the day, obviously, other than the work that we do, of course, which entails
I remember the day very well. I was working in Milwaukee. I was a senior at Marquette University. I could tell you, like, the thoughts I had in my head that morning, and I got called into work at WTMJ Radio, and just sitting there all day taking in closures, because everybody was shutting down. Schools were closing, the malls were closing, people were going home. That day is seared into my memory. Most surreal thing that happened to me this week was my daughter, who's in fifth grade, about to turn 11. This is history class for her. And this is something you learn about in social studies, and this is something that a day I'll never forget.
Yeah, and she's just now learning.
She's just now learning about it, yeah.
Yeah. Does anybody else do anything to mark the day, or?
So I was a reporter in Los Angeles interviewing panicked tourists outside Hollywood sort of theme parks and attractions. And, you know, it was really, my kids are about the same age as yours, Rob, and sort of explaining of what it was like to relive or to live through that day and sort of reliving it through their experience of it. It makes you feel very old, but it also sort of gives you an understanding of just what a cataclysmic event that truly was.
And what we all lived through, and of course we'll never forget, and our, you know, thoughts and memories are with thoughts and legitimate prayers are with the people who lost family members that day. That is where we're going to have to leave it, though, for Week in Review. We're out of time. Thank you to Michael Liptrot, Heather Sharone, Laura Rodriguez-Presa, and Rob Hart. Thank you, everybody. And we're back to wrap things up right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Polk Brothers Foundation. Additional support is provided by...
And that's our show for this Friday night. If you're looking for more backstory and context on the biggest news of the day, sign up for our email newsletter, The Daily Chicagoan. Not only do we peel back the onion on complicated issues happening across the city, some of them smell, but we also introduce you to new ways to explore Chicago. You can sign up at WTTW.com/newsletter. Now for the Week in Review, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night. Okay, so Bears, anyone?
There's a new restaurant opening there
in
the South Loop by one of the former Bears.
Oh, is it Adonijay? Yeah. Okay.
Is it right next to my apartment?
I think it's the Staley. Because it's Staley the Bear is the mascot.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I learn something every day.
Well, yeah. I was raised in the Bears religion household.
Yes, you were.
So that's, yeah.
Wait, last Sunday's game was a lot of fun. That was great atmosphere.
They won.
Yeah. Well, they won, but apparently Caleb did not do what Caleb was supposed to do.
Opening night jitters.
I hope
the Texans are good, though.
They are good.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that is committed to supporting diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives throughout the legal profession.